This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The world's thirst for more minerals has corporations and others now turning to mine a region of the world that had previously been left relatively undisturbed, the ocean floor. What might the ramifications of mining the deep sea be on the ocean's ecosystem health? What precautions should be taken to prevent devastating the fragile ecosystems? With us are two experts. Craig Smith is a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii, and Verena Tunnicliffe is a marine biologist and a Canada research chair in deep ocean research at the University of Victoria in Canada. They are co-authors of the study, Deep Sea Misconceptions Cause Underestimation of Seabed Mining Impacts. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Craig Smith and Verena Tunnicliffe.
This new exploration of deep sea mining, there seems to be conflicting thoughts about this. On one hand, we could be severely damaging the ocean ecosystems in ways that we don't understand. On the other, I understand these metals are sort of needed for a renewable revolution. So are we just trading one environmental disaster for another?
First of all, I want to say that I'm a scientist and I'm not for or against mining, but I think everybody that's involved, all stakeholders, need to know the consequences of activities that are undertaken, for example, in the deep ocean for deep sea mining. And it's pretty clear that deep sea mining, especially for polymetallic nodules or manganese nodules, as they are also called, will have a major environmental footprint. It'll cause substantial damage over thousands to hundreds of thousands of kilometers of seafloor. So the environmental impacts will be major, and the changes, the harm to the ecosystems will be permanent, essentially, because there are organisms that live nowhere else but on these nodules on the bottom of the ocean. And when you take them away, it takes millions of years for them to grow. Now, if we step back and look at things on a global scale, society may decide that it is worth these environmental costs to mine these metals from the seafloor for electric vehicle batteries, etc. But that's not a judgment I can make. I can't really judge the economics and environmental impacts in other ecosystems, but I can judge what they will be in the deep sea. And it's important to recognize that they will be substantial.
Well, let's talk about the deep sea for a moment. So I've been looking at some of your papers, and it says that we've got really a huge amount of the world's ocean there, volume representing the largest and least explored biome on Earth. What can you tell us about what we have studied to date and what we know about this part of the planet and the ocean?
What we do know about the deep sea is that it's very heterogeneous. There are lots of different kinds of habitats and different kinds of biodiversity. For example, hydrothermal vents are one very remarkable type of ecosystem where there are giant tube worms and all kinds of novel organisms adapted to this extreme environment. And we also have other kinds of habitats like seamounts that are very different from hydrothermal vents or from nodule fields, and different biodiversity. And the nodule fields themselves are really unusual, radically different from other parts of the deep sea. And they have also very high biodiversity and a huge list of undescribed species that are new to science. Most of the species we haven't collected, and those that we have collected are new to science. So and we can say that the deep sea in general harbors remarkable biodiversity and lots of different ecosystems, but we still are very early on in characterizing this biodiversity.
So for those of us who are not marine biologists or marine ecologists, what are all these critters you've just been talking about?
Well, some of them are giant tube worms that are a couple meters long. There are lots of different kinds of worms, polychaete worms that have amazing adaptations. I mean, some of them don't look like worms at all. They look like big orange floating animals, balloons. And then there are lots of different kinds of crustaceans. And actually, quite a high diversity of deep sea fishes.
Verena?
What are the animals? They are denizens of the deep that we never see further up. For us living on land, they represent the inhabitants of an alien world that seems to be totally unconnected with us. And yet, we're talking about ecosystems that have adapted to their environment for millennia after millennia. So there's an intrinsic value in these bizarre things, which us scientists give all sorts of wonderful names to. You can create stories about each one of these little critters, and I love the little stories, but so what? The so what really comes in the concept of the deep ocean being an integrated part of our planet that we're only just understanding. Whereas humans have had impact for tens to hundreds of thousands of years on the land, we haven't really got there much in the deep ocean. It's getting there. We're starting to affect the deep sea. But this is a place that has yet to really feel the full hammer of human ambition. And why these ecosystems might matter to us is part of that whole connectedness. So, for example, the ocean serves as a huge sink for the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere. And the biggest reservoir of carbon dioxide on our planet is in the deep ocean. It's being pulled down. And so one of the services these ecosystems do for us is processing our foolishness in putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So there's things they do for us. There's ways in which our food production is connected to the deep sea. So if one believes in the ecosystems of the planet working together, these do represent our most furthest ones and the ones we know the least about. But for that very reason, those knowledge gaps and stepping carefully becomes really important.
So Verena Tunnicliffe, we opened the conversation about this juxtaposition between the drive to renewable energy, which is part of why they're driving to mine in the deep ocean, to stop putting carbon dioxide into the air, and yet the possibility of trading one ecological disaster for another, and whether that deep sea mining is just going to be so irreparable that it's kind of counter affects the good that might come from getting those minerals. Do you have a sense of that?
I have a sense of the question. It's a risk analysis one makes. And one interesting question is it going to make any difference in the long run? Partly the place I'm going is that I'm not sure we're going to change anything with land-based mining, for one thing. Simply because if it's there, we're going to go for it. For feeding the renewables market, one issue is if we keep feeding the same minerals into it and making access to the minerals, are we curbing the innovations that will begin to wean us off the need for those particular minerals? I mean, there are, I'm not a technologist in terms of how batteries work, but I do understand there are other potential ways of building batteries. There are other potential kinds of energy resources. So at what point do we stop and think about how we work in terms of needing or using those metals versus, okay, here's another source, so let's just go for it? Are we having the right social discussion? And it is time to include humankind. This is the heritage of humankind on the seafloor. That's part of the law of the sea. And so perhaps the social conversation needs to happen to understand all aspects of it.
And part of that discussion needs to be a really objective assessment of what the impact of mining will be. A major issue is that I'm absolutely convinced that the potential impacts of mining are being minimized. They're being glossed over because most of the general public doesn't know enough about the deep sea to realize that some of the statements about what these impacts will be like are just unrealistic and purposely naive, I think.
So what should the public know?
I think the public should know, for example, I'm particularly specialist on manganese nodule ecosystems and what mining impacts will be, that these are, number one, the most pristine habitats on the planet. Yes, there are some microplastics make it down there, but in general, these are the largest, you know, habitat areas of wilderness left on the planet. And they also are among the most stable and probably the least resilient to human disturbances of any ecosystem. For example, mining will inevitably raise a sediment plume or resuspend sediment and put it up in the water column. And the Clipperton-Clarion Zone has the clearest bottom waters on the planet, clearer than anywhere else in the ocean. They're so clear that their bottom waters are clear, there's less suspended sediment or particles than in the clearest surface waters of the ocean. If you go in the middle of the most nutrient-poor oceans, the water is not as clear as it is in the bottom of the Clipperton-Clarion Zone. So what that tells you is these communities are adapted to very low concentrations of sediment particles. They have all kinds of adaptations that rely, that are dependent on these conditions. And so when you perturb this ecosystem by resuspending large plumes of sediment, you'll bury animals, you interfere with their ability to respire, you'll smother them, not just animals, but also microbes or bacteria, et cetera. And also, most of the animals in the deep sea use light in their ecology. They create light. And sediment plumes will black this out. It'll be dark clouds of sediment preventing organisms from finding mates, from finding prey, etc. So these are very stable ecosystems in the Clipperton-Clarion Zone. They're a target for nodule mining, and they also have really high diversity, some of the highest diversities of seafloor communities anywhere in the ocean. And we don't really know why. We know that that's true, but we don't know what processes are driving that.
Verena Tunnicliffe, would you add anything to that?
I think I'd love the public to know a little bit about the ecosystem that I love in the deep sea, which is hydrothermal hot vents. And the particular issue here is that the hot vent ecosystem has its own group of species that live there. They're not found anywhere else in the world. And we've learned so much about the origin of life and life's adaptations in really extreme circumstances, to the point where the lessons from hydrothermal vents are now driving exploration in outer space. That's how fundamental the discoveries have been. And yet the size of these ecosystems is tiny. Unlike what Craig is talking about, fairly large areas in the abyss, the hydrothermal vents cluster around these tiny hot springs, which also form the deposits of interest to miners. And animals are living on those deposits. Now, when we estimate the total area of hydrothermal vents in the world, we've got something that's maybe 30 to 50 square kilometers. That's it. That's tiny. Think of Central Park in New York City or some small island in the Caribbean. That's the total area. We are told that miners probably won't want to go next to near hot water. So that's great. I love to hear that. But we must put them under protection, officially under protection. If indeed they aren't going to mine them, and they do recognize that they're special, then they have to be entrenched in the regulations. And we're not quite hearing that discussion happening. So that's one of the three resources that's being targeted.
So in these vents that you're talking about, you said the critters are living on the deposits that have the very minerals that these companies and societies are therefore after.
The same is true on the nodules with their own critters growing on them. The same is true on the cobalt crusts on the seamounts. So on the seamounts, tops of seamounts, we have the ancient corals, we have the sponges, we have a diverse community that is on, I mean, you've got to remove the substratum, and therefore the habitat's gone. And so for most of these habitats, the formation of that substratum has taken thousands to millions of years.
And one of the key things, and this is the way nature works, when you have a specialized habitat or a specialized set of conditions that produce a mineral resource, that's also a specialized habitat. So where you find minerals that are remarkably rich in metals that can be used in batteries on the seafloor anywhere, it's going to be a different kind of ecosystem than places that don't have those minerals. And so you have specially adapted communities. And so you can't harvest a remarkable and unusual resource on the seafloor without damaging an unusual community. That's just That's how life works. That's how evolution works.
And then if they do end up damaging that community, what you are saying is that we don't really know the repercussions that might trickle beyond that, the interconnection of the ecosystems. Yeah. Marina, I see you nodding.
Yep. Yeah. You think about things on land which have been, you know, removed for lifetimes, many, many people's lifetimes, and how mountain, you know, alpine regions have completely changed, or you've changed something over to agriculture and you've lost completely the original ecosystems. I mean, to some extent, we don't even know how much we've already changed life on land. So with the removal of the fundamental habitat, you are not going to see a quick reforestation or whatever you want, or restoration of the communities that are gone. And so part of the problem here is just understanding the ramifications of that and trying to model what that might look like when you have no baseline.
So what can we propose that might protect to some degree if they are determined to start mining in the oceans? How can we conserve what is necessary to protect life, protect biodiversity, protect the potential ripple effects to the rest of the planet?
There are a variety of approaches. One fundamental approach to protecting biodiversity and ecosystem functions is to protect enough of the ecosystems in the area that are being exploited, put them in no mining areas or marine protected areas so that you maintain biodiversity and the ecosystem functions, the services that are provided by that region. And that's being done to some degree and for nodule mining, and it's in the planning stages for mining of massive sulfides, the extinct vents. But that's just one thing. Spatial management is really important. Another thing that I think is really clearly important is what a lot of scientists call the precautionary approach, that you assume the worst reasonable scenario and you plan, you manage for that until you can show otherwise. And in fact, the scale of impacts are less than the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. And so my feeling for manganese nodule mining is that in space and time scales of impacts are so poorly known that I really... A responsible way to proceed with mining would be to start with one mining operation and really study it for the decades or so required to get a full understanding of the scales of impact. And if we see that it's enormous and it's really threatening biodiversity and ecosystem services in this whole area, then we stop at one. But if we see we can scale up from that. And I think most scientists would agree that one mining operation that the Pinclarian zone and probably one mining of an operation of a massive sulfide, if done properly with appropriate mitigation measures, et cetera, probably is not going to cause large-scale damage to the ocean and to biodiversity. So we probably can do it on a small scale and get an understanding of what the real ramifications are. Maybe Marina can comment. But I think that's really important, to the precautionary approach, that we proceed carefully one step at a time rather than just allowing large-scale mining to occur in lots of different places at lots of different, you know, simultaneously.
Marina, would you agree?
I would, and I'm going to make a comment about the conservation of marine protected areas. Craig was very influential in getting some protected areas established in the nodule mining fields, but the problem that his team had was that the contracts were already signed, and there was the spaces where you might choose to put the conservation areas weren't available. And the same thing is true for the hydrothermal vent system. So we've already got 30 contracts signed around the world for mining operations, and none of them were signed with the idea of where conservation areas should go in.
So where are the contracts that you know about? Where are they proposing to start mining?
Well, there are 16 in the Clipperton Clarion Zone, each of them up to 75,000 square kilometers. And then there are a number of other, they're called reserve areas that are reserved for mining by developing nations or by the International Seabed Authority itself, the regulatory body that regulates mining in areas at the seabed and areas beyond national jurisdiction. And then Verena can comment on how many, there are some claim, I've forgotten exactly how many, I think it's six that are on seamount systems, seamount cobalt systems.
And then, yes, there are five or six. And those are mostly in the Western Pacific between Wake Island and Guam. And then there's one off Brazil, and those are for seamounts. And then there's an additional seven for hydrothermal vents, four in the Atlantic, and at least three in the Indian Ocean, which is a place we have very little exploration.
Which are the minerals that they are most after?
The metals that make the most economic drivers are nickel and cobalt. Those are the two big ones. And then you can make money from the copper and the manganese. And then there's other metals that can come out of them. Mm. The nodules are of particular interest because they have such a high concentration, and that there isn't a whole lot of extra processing you have to do once you've got it through a processing plant.
I think gold is also a mineral of interest for the massive sulfides.
Yes, it is. Depends on the deposit. You aren't going to get a lot of gold out of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge sulfides.
I know the United Nations, as you guys mentioned, also is trying to put together some agreements about how we move forward, if we move forward with these. If we have enough marine protected areas, perhaps it won't be too devastating. Is that what you're saying?
Well... No.
Okay, good. Thank you.
You're saying, you asked us what was one way to mitigate, and that's the beginning of mitigation. But I think Craig's point of going slowly, here we are going into the decade of the ocean, a decade that's starting 2020 to try and understand more about our ocean, and maybe full steam ahead is perhaps not the best approach at the moment, perhaps beginning to look carefully and carefully monitor what would happen as we slowly move forward is really the best way to go, so that you can begin to do those designs of mitigation much more carefully.
Craig Smith?
Yeah, and I think one thing to recognize is that the pattern at which humans exploit resources, and stakeholders have said, well, you know, we're not going to mine all the mining claims in the Clipperton and Clarion Zone at once. We're, you know, the global market, metals market can't sustain that. So we're just going to mine one, and then we'll move over here and maybe mine another. Maybe there'll be two or three going on simultaneously. But the bottom line is the way humans exploit resources is once something's economically viable, they exploit it until it's gone. We're not leaving any oil in the ground, and now we're getting tar sands and things. So if it's economically viable and can be used in human society, the exploitation will keep going. And in the Clipperton Clarion Zone, no area will have recovered from mining damage before the last area is mined, even if it's centuries from now. So you can't think of these individual mining operations in isolation. It's not just one mine, oh, we'll mine here, and then 20 years later, we'll mine over here, and that first one will have recovered. No, it won't recover. It won't recover for millions of years. You've got to really think holistically and long-term about how you manage this. And marine protected areas are essential, but also having a good understanding of the scales of impact, both at the seafloor and the water column, and even connectivity to food webs to humans, those are lacking, and those are really important to understand.
Well, Craig Smith and Verena Tunnicliffe, I thank you both so very much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Your interest.
Craig Smith is a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii, and Verena Tunnicliffe is a marine biologist and a Canada research chair in deep ocean research at the University of Victoria in Canada. They are co-authors of the study, Deep Sea Misconceptions Cause Underestimation of Seabed Mining Impacts.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.